Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'm here in the writer's room with Bruce Miller, the creator of The Handmaid's Tale. And rather than do a normal introduction, I figured I'd let Bruce set the scene for us. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are?
Right now we're in my office, which is part of the writer's office. We have a few bulletin boards up here with cards that represent the first few episodes of season two, which is what we're working on now.
So if I look at those, will I be killed in a tragic death? I'll be put on the wall.
And the way we break stories is by putting them, putting each beat, each kind of different story moment onto index cards and putting up on a board, and then you can move them around and stuff like that. It's very, very, non-exciting, old school, low tech stuff.
So you've been doing this a long time, right? When did you started at ER? Is that right?
One of my first TV jobs was ER. My first real TV job. I was on a show called Higher Ground before that on Fox Family, which was a great experience, and it taught me a ton. And Matt Hastings and a few other people who I worked with on that show, I'm still working with, amazingly enough. We had some. A.J. Cook was in that show. Hayden Christensen was on that show. It was
and
a great.
When was that?
It was somewhere in the 1840s, I think. It was quite a while ago. I don't really remember. Oh no, maybe it was probably about. I'm measuring from how old my children are. I think it was about 18 years ago, I guess, because my son was not quite born yet.
And so, think back then. At what point did you decide I want to create The Handmaid's Tale into a television show?
I wish it worked like that. I wish you were sitting home and you said, I really want to do this. And you just pick up the phone and then the next thing you're on the set. Oh, yeah. I read The Handmaid's Tale when I was in college in a new fiction class, which tells you how long ago I was in college. And it was a little seminar with six or seven people. I don't really remember the professor, and the only book I remember from that class is Handmaid's Tale. And I read it, and I just loved it as a book. I was starting to think about being a writer, and it really taught me a lot about kind of how language could work or language did work, and also about storytelling and about, how important point of view was. And I am rather to seriously dyslexic. So books, it takes me a long time to read a book, and then I tend to read them over and over again. I don't know whether that's something all dyslexics do or not. So I read it a bunch of times over the years, The Handmaid's Tale. I always loved it. It was just one of my favorite books. And I heard they were making a movie about it, and then I saw the movie and I was like, yeah. And then I heard they were making a TV show about it. And that was great. I was just thinking of it as, ooh, a fan. I love this story. It's going to be great to see. But as the years went by and the show didn't appear, I started to have my agents check every year. And as it didn't get made, my career moved along and I got better. And then, there came a time when the original people involved in the project were moved on to other things. Eileen Chaikin, who was originally for years, really championed this project. And really this is, this is her success as well. I mean, getting it on the air. But Eileen was off doing Empire. little show called Empire. And she was unavailable, and I think heartbroken that she was unavailable to write the show for Hulu, but they started to look for a showrunner. And luckily by that point, my resume had expanded enough, and more than my resume, my actual experience to do a show, to run a show without the right experience is just, I can't even imagine how horrible it would be. Difficult. And so, but they were looking for a female showrunner.
And so that and was I'm my not. Next question. So so it's a show about women and what happens to them in this dystopian future. It's written by a woman. You've got a lot of women in the writer's room. How did you end up becoming the guy who ran the show? And has that been a pro or a con, or how do you perceive that? I mean, it's obviously been a pro. You've been the show is incredible.
Think of how good it would be if I was a woman. it was difficult. I mean, it wasn't just difficult because I had to convince other people to trust me. I had to convince myself that, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the book. I was looking forward to the TV show. Just because I'm making it doesn't mean I'm not still looking forward to it. The last thing you want to do is be the ruiner of The Handmaid's Tale. And it is, a female-centered book. It's centered in a female mind, and female relationships. And it's so it's such a important, I didn't want to say seminal female feminist work, because that's not the right combination of word roots, but it's such an important feminist book that I was very sensitive about doing it, and I did think that my gender was a hindrance. So, but when you work in TV, because we work in a writing staff with a bunch of people, you always have weaknesses, and you're always trying to bolster those weaknesses with the people around you. So, if you're working on a sciencey show, and you're not sciencey, you hire sciencey people. Because, I come with a certain set of skills, and my skills are very much, I'm very interested in characters. I'm very interested in point of view. I'm very interested in kind of interesting storytelling, but I'm not a woman. And you need someone who's going to bring that perspective, that way of going through the world to the show. And so, being mindful of it is one thing, but you actually have to figure out ways to address it. You can't just be sensitive to it. You actually think of practical ways to do it. And so, I started to think about who I would hire on my writing staff. That's really the first step. I mean, first you're hiring Elizabeth Moss, who not only is such a, was perfect for the role, but she was a producer on the project. She's a very intelligent, thoughtful, passionate, stubborn woman, is spectacular in every way to work with. And so that helped right from the get-go. You have a voice in her.
Did what was your first experience like meeting Margaret Atwood?
Terrifying.
Sure.
Most of the time when you work on a book, especially a classic book, the author is not – still knocking around.
Yeah.
And Margaret is very much knocking around. Knockwood. And my first experience meeting her was in Toronto, but we exchanged a lot of emails and got to know each other quite a bit that way, and also talking about story points, story moments in great detail. So by the time I met her, I at least I had a bit of a working relationship with her. But she's, remarkably good at making other people relaxed around Margaret Atwood. I think it's her full-time job. So I went up and we were talking, we had breakfast, and she hadn't at that point yet read the pilot and the first episode. But soon after that, she did, and that was a very nerve-wracking experience. But she liked him quite a bit.
Right.
I think once I was very keen to have her insight, not just in like her permission. I wanted to talk to her. She's a exceptional storyteller. I wanted to talk to her about story, and so that was very helpful. Because
did she have notes on the first episode? And
thoughts, notes. I mean, everybody has notes. That's why you give people things to read. You want their opinion. I mean, notes have a bit of a bad taste to them, that word. But yeah. I think you want people's response because that's event. I'm not writing a script for me. I'm writing a script for actors who are going to perform it, if what's in it, it doesn't make sense or is, doesn't track or isn't interesting, it's not going to, they're not going to make it interesting. So you really want people to respond as an audience. And so Margaret remarkably was able to do that. And also she had she wrote the book, I don't know, 30 something years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she sat down to type like 40 years ago, and she remembered so much of why she made every little decision.
That's fascinating.
Which was fascinating. And she's written a ton of books in the interim. So she's gone through this process a lot. Just that why she decided I wrote a pilot for HBO with my wife about the Salem witch trials. With Jenji Cohn and Gus Van Sant. It was a really fun project, but the research was fascinating. And I know there's a lot of parallels between the way Gilead is organized and the kind of totalitarian theocracy it is, and the Puritan totalitarian theocracy that, we have this misguided idea that America was a place of religious freedom when, in fact, people came here to escape religious persecution, but they didn't want religious freedom for anybody but themselves. And they enforced that quite strictly, especially in New England. But I knew that they used the Geneva Bible, not the King James Bible. The King James Bible is what Margaret uses in the book. The quotations are from the King James Bible. There are huge differences in, like everything else, there's huge differences in those texts. And so I asked her, because there's nobody else you can ask on the planet.
Yeah.
Why did you choose this and not this? And because she knew the Geneva Bible. She knew that was more the tradition of the Puritans. And she said, the King James Bible sounded better. And she's right. The Geneva Bible is terrible, just, completely, twisted up everywhere. I mean, they were trying to make sure that they made their, ideological point, but boy, it's not pretty, but the King James Bible is. And so to be able to talk to her and get the specific, and you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And that went all the way down the road in a million different directions. Like, why did you decide the colonies would be this? Where did you think, where did the new ants come from? Are they, do people volunteer to be ants? All of those questions, you could see her kind of go back in time and kind of going, I thought about this, I thought about this, I thought about this, and this was the decision. Well, to lay that bare for me, just as a writer, was exceedingly like a treasure trove. And I think for Margaret too, as she's gotten to know the writers and as she's, it's really fun for her to have a bunch of people who take what she says, take it very seriously, and extrapolate out in really interesting and surprising ways. I think she's really enjoying it.
So I've been watching the show with my wife, and it's amazing. And I'll get nervous a lot of times in the middle of the show, and I'll pause it and pretend I have to go to the bathroom or check on the baby, even though the baby's fast asleep. When you first saw the pilot, the thing that you had created for the first time, was it as nerve-wracking for you as the creator? And why is it you think that it is so nerve-wracking, unlike most shows out there?
It wasn't as nerve-wracking for me.
Because you knew what was going to happen.
partially because I knew what was going to happen, and partially because what you saw was me going through 10,000 times and making sure it was nerve-wracking for you. So the first version wasn't as nerve-wracking. And also, I just tend to look at it differently. I'm trying to get it to be nerve-wracking, so I only see the parts that aren't. It's difficult to kind of get that.
I wasn't aware that there were any parts that aren't nerve-wracking.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think one of the reasons it's so nerve-wracking, really two things. First, is that there are always stakes. There's the possibility of being pulled out of your life and executed for doing something so minor, that you wouldn't even think of it these days as an action, looking at someone a particular way, saying a particular set of words, being in the slightest bit, defiant. You would never think of those things. But they, the rules in Gilead are very, very strict, and any small deviation is punished very severely. And so, but Gilead's not wrong. Those things are defiances. Those things are the beginning of rebellion. So the interesting thing is that the stakes are very high both sides. If you do it, the downside is you might be executed. But the good side is you might make a connection, make a friend, find a way to survive. So the stakes are high. You really want to do it. It's not as if there's only sticks. There's also carrots for everybody, emotional, sociological carrots. So I think that the reason you're so tense is that you're rooting for her to do the things that she's doing, but you don't want her to do the things that she's doing because you don't want her to get caught. And the other thing that really makes it work, and this is I think was my first principle for the show, was it has to feel real. It has to feel like real life. Once it stops feeling like real life, you're like, oh, that would never happen. And then you're not involved. And one of our focuses has been, you know, Lizzie, that character of June feels like a real person. She's not more brave. She's not less brave. She's not more, she doesn't have more self-control or less self-control. She isn't stupid, but she certainly isn't, you know, Jason Bourne. This is not a situation any of us would be used to dealing with. And also she's, trying to keep her kind of spirited self alive inside, which is just, that's a level of rebellion that we can all relate to, but that's kind of her biggest rebellion. It makes you root for her. It doesn't have as many stakes until it starts to come out, but you are liking the internal voice so much, you want it to come out. So what I'm trying to do in the audience is make them want things to happen that are terribly dangerous, and so that's why you're so tense all the time, is the things you want are the things you don't want.
Yeah, I had a few moments staring at the TV and I was like, don't go in there. It's like
the character
in the theater.
Yeah, exactly. You like, turn into the person in the theater on 42nd Street screaming at the screen, yeah.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So I want to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, SeatGeek. It's an app I've personally been using on my phone a lot lately to buy tickets to concerts, sporting events, theaters, comedy events, you name it. There's all these different ways that you can use the app. You can search for tickets based on price. You can search based on finding amazing deals. It's really a fantastic experience. One of the things that I love about it compared to other ticketing experiences is that they grade every seat based on how much money you want to spend. And then you can figure out which seats fit your budget the best. Plus, and this is for me the biggest bonus of all of it, is that every single ticket you buy on SeatGeek is fully guaranteed. So you know that you're not getting some fake kind of ripoff thing that you would get on Craigslist. SeatGeek has become my go-to app for finding the best deals for all these kinds of events. I absolutely love it. Best of all, my listeners today are going to get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the SeatGeek app. And then you enter the promo code HIVE, that's HIVE. Once again, download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code HIVE, and you're going to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. I promise you, you'll have a blast no matter what you end up doing. So it's interesting that you talk about it feeling real. One of the things that I've seen on online, on social media and news articles and so on, and I've also tweeted a few things myself, is there are scenes in the show that are direct mirrors, black mirrors, if you will, to things that are happening today. You know, there's a moment where, in the protests, there are scenes that take place in Russia a few weeks ago with protesters literally you could take one of those stills and swap them and you wouldn't know what the difference is. Do you think that part of the tenseness and part of the fact that this show has been doing so well right this moment is because of the world we live in today?
Absolutely. I know for me, as a personal, it was a personal, very strange experience to the particular scene you're talking about. We shot this protest scene. It was mentioned in the book very briefly, a couple of sentences, but we extrapolated it out and said, oh, this is going to be interesting. We should show this on dramatize it. So we did it. And then while I was editing, there was the Women's March in D.C.
Yeah.
And you're seeing exactly the same signs, exactly the same images, and you're also seeing, Capitol Police with guns, not firing them, thank God, but, it's the same image. And it was terrifying. I mean, it happened all through the process. We did stories about people, Americans escaping to Canada, American refugees, and you know, a few weeks later, there were images that were just like the images from our show of people in America escaping to Canada to get some security in their lives, to try to feel like the government wasn't going to kick them out. And so I think that one of the things that TV has, which is wonderful, is that you can kind of bend it and flex it as you make it. You know, you're kind of driving the Indianapolis 500 and painting the car at the same time. So you can change things. So you can adjust to what's going on in the world. And when Margaret wrote the book, she said, there's nothing that happens in the book that hasn't happened in real life. And we have definitely, you know, subscribed to that. With this kind of material, on a very basic level, with the I don't want to be in the business of inventing cruelties, and I certainly don't want to be in the business of inventing cruelties for women. It goes back to your other question, which is, you know, why, you know, what makes me think that I could do a show about misogyny? And there's a great line from a gentleman who wrote a book, said, well, men invented it, so why shouldn't we be making television shows about it? You know, we don't go looking for things to invent.
Yeah, that was my next question. Do you look at the real atrocities we see happening today? I mean, you know, it was interesting because you know, in the scenes where there's the stonings of people to be killed and so on and so forth, those are things that happen today.
Every day.
And
female genital mutilation every day, and every day sometimes in America, not just, in parts of the world that are far away from us and feel far away from us.
Do you look at those things and say we have to kind of put those in the show, or is it more?
It's a little more organic than that, but it's close. It's different in a few important ways. I don't think anybody's out there reading the paper saying, we should do this, we should do that, we should do this. When I think about the show and the way that our writing staff thinks about the show is we are very much telling a story of Offred. So you putting her in the situations she would be put in, unfortunately, she doesn't have a ton of agency in her day. And then playing out those scenarios. Those scenarios in Gilead often lead us to the same kind of situations you are led to in the real world that kind of are the environment for some terrible, oppressive misogyny. And so our story of female genital mutilation about a character named Emily, who was played by Alexis Bledel, astonishingly, she's a lesbian woman. She is convicted of having a lesbian relationship. And we were just thinking about how would they punish her? I mean, you know, we know that that's not legal in Gilead. That's one of our rules. They're quite kind of in a strange, ridiculous way. Just they think lesbianism is ooky. It seems like they're all so freaked out.
Sounds awfully Republican.
But it sounds awfully, yeah. I mean, I thought it sounded awfully, you know, Republican from 30 years ago, but I guess I was wrong. But so we looked into female genital mutilation because we wanted to see about, well, why would they do that? And people act, and it is used for exactly this purpose, which is to restrict female sex drive, you know, to be inappropriate sexuality, a child caught masturbating, something like that. And so it just seemed like a perfect match. But I think that we are – the writers in general and the cast in general are very newsy people, very news junkie people. So I don't think it's – people aren't going out and looking for stuff, but everybody's very, very aware. I think probably our writing room in general watches more news and reads more news than fiction.
So one of the things you talked about, how you have I think you're incredibly good at character, and one of the things I found so fascinating that my wife actually mentioned is that all of the women in the show are fully formed characters. They have backstories and things like that, and the men not as much. Was that intentional?
Not completely. I mean, I very much follow my curiosity with this show and the curiosity of the writing staff. When I read the book, there were things I wanted to know more about. And I didn't know Margaret Atwood, and I had no way of finding out more. So you read the book over and over again. You find out more interesting things. You can extrapolate out from little moments. And then when I got the chance to do the show, I've just been following like, oh, this would be interesting. I want to know what happens here. And so I'm interested in all the characters and all of their backstories. But it is a show where June is the point of view. And so to a certain degree, the flashbacks are things that at some point June would know, that someone would have told her that, or, you know, at some point she would have found something out, whether or not it's now or after Gilead Falls when she's reading, you know, people's diaries or documents that were left behind. So that's really kind of the logical route I'm going is where is there a place where she might have found out about this? And so, you know, I don't look at it. I really don't look at it as a male female thing. I look at it as the show centered on Offred. It's her point of view. Who would she have an easier time understanding, and who would she have a less easier time of understanding? I think the commander who Joseph Fiennes plays is absolutely fascinating, but kind of opaque.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great things. You don't want to peel back too much because I don't know that Offred, June, it's hard not to call her Offred. I don't know that June knows very much about him. Or in fact, if she found out stuff, how would she process it and put it together? Like, oh, these are the building blocks of this gentleman. So I think that until I feel like June really starts to understand the guy's backstory, I don't want to lay it out. And that's back to point of view and to feel like you're looking at the world through Lizzie's eyes.
What's one of your favorite scenes in the book and the show? Is there, you know, a moment that if you had to take one little clip, one paragraph or chapter, what would you say is your favorite moment?
Well, can I take two?
Yeah, of course. You can take as many as you want.
Oh, okay. Well, then let's start with
pilot teaser.
Pilot teaser. I'm going to take one from the book and one that wasn't in the book, but certainly was inspired by the book. One of my favorite things from the book is the very, very beginning when she's in her room. And the reason. There's two reasons. One, it was incredibly effective when I read it in the book. Just the writing and the pace that you immediately get of someone who is living a very slow, careful life.
And you put this. You actually took this and put it in the beginning of the show. It's the same exact language, right?
It's close. It's 99%. I mean, even when I take something out of the book, and I take a lot of stuff directly out of the book. You end up fussing with it a little bit. And, you know, at the beginning, that's very hard to say, oh, let me just fix up this Margaret Atwood, you know, this is such, you know, pedestrian writing. I'm going to really put my stamp. Mostly what we're doing is trimming and, you know, moving little pieces around that might not quite make sense in context, but we are, you know, have a great amount of fealty to the book and the text. But I loved how immediately she establishes the internal pace of June's monologue, and that it was a way to survive the incredible boredom and slow pace of this world. And so I know it sounds weird, but a pacing trick like that, it's so... So many levels down in terms of storytelling, so complicated, but she does it absolutely effortlessly. Margaret does at the beginning of the book. You know, she does it with, you know, it's words and periods, you know, it's a table, a chair, a lamp, and all of a sudden you're slowing down as well. And I was just always so impressed by that. So as far as Margaret, I mean, that's one of my favorite moments, and it's so beautiful, and Lizzie has so much going on. I don't know if you know, she memorizes all the voiceover and does it in her head as she's sitting there silently doing the scene, which is, one of the reasons the performance is so incredible. And one of the reasons we end up cutting out a lot of voiceover, because you can read it on her face. The scene that there are so many scenes in the show that I'm in love with, but there's a couple of scenes in the episode where we show the backstory of how June and Luke met. And there's a scene in a restaurant where they are talking about not sleeping together. It's probably 4 minutes, 5 minutes long. It's not anything you normally see on a TV show. It's, I think, an incredible performance from both of them. It feels really real. But it's just this, like, masterclass in, like, emotional discomfort and reading signals and people saying things that aren't true. And the way that they do it and how much you feel from both of them, I just thought it was remarkable. And there's a scene later in that episode, which was one of my favorite scenes and shows you how strange my idea of a favorite scene is that June is in bed after her, you know, she's been having an affair with Luke, and Luke comes in and she just says, "I want you to leave your wife." And he says, "Okay."
Yeah, I thought that was brilliant.
And it was one of my favorite moments. And when I thought about when we worked on that scene, it was always that simple. And the thing that I loved about it was just that, you know, there's a line in the movie Moonstruck where John Patrick Shanley writes that, you know, love just screws everything up. You know, everybody talks about, you know, love is it's a big mess. It makes everything awful, you know, and you know, there's nothing nice, neat, and clean about it. And you should just forget that that's the way the story is supposed to end because it's big and messy. And I always felt like that really rang true in that scene for me, is that I love the way Luke is like, you know, he agrees, okay, we're going to, you know, I'm going to leave my wife. And June is immediately like, "What do you mean, okay? What do you mean? Hey, wait, what do you mean?" And he says, "Well, what else am I going to do? I'm in love with you." And there's this great, like, it's this warm, wonderful feeling and this terrible feeling of inevitability. And there was something so remarkable about the way that they played it, and something, there's a connection that seems timeless between the two of them, so that no matter how long the show goes on, you feel like in some ways they are, they're fastened together. They are two pieces of Lego that are not coming apart.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Like many of you, I've become a voracious podcast listener. One of my favorites is a podcast called Better Off with Jill Schlesinger. Jill interviews informative and entertaining guests each week to uncover surprising financial insights, and she does it without all that financial jargon that none of us understand. It's a great show because it's not just entertaining and fascinating to listen to, but it also gives you actionable information to make the most of your money. She did this recently in an episode that features Michael Lewis, the best-selling author, my colleague at Vanity Fair. You might recognize Michael's work. He's the author of Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short. Many of these are New York Times bestsellers that have been turned into amazing films, and you should read all of them. I'm a huge fan of Michael's work, and he's been a huge inspiration to me, my own book writing. In his sit-down with Jill, Michael focuses on his latest book, The Undoing Project, which explores how a strange friendship led to the creation of the field of behavioral economics, which in turn revolutionized big data studies, advanced evidence-based medicine, and led to a new approach in government regulation. Be sure to check out Michael Lewis on Better Off with Jill Schlesinger wherever you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. It is absolutely a great, great podcast to listen to. So I have been a technology reporter for a long time and, you know, have these fears that one day, you know, the power will go out or, you know, and we could fall into chaos. And I've probably read too many Cormac McCarthy books, but every time Donald Trump tweets, you know, I end up going on Amazon and like buying a new earthquake supply kit. My basement is literally just filled with all these things. Do you ever worry that we will fall into some sort of dystopian future like this? Not like this specifically with like a Gilead and things like that, but you know, when you look at how there's a piece in Harper's this week, which is really fascinating, and it's a little hyperbolic, but where it talks about how, you know, in Hitler's rise, there was one major event that happened where they changed the laws and said, you know, people can't speak freely, they can't organize, they started refusing to let the press be free and so on and so forth. You could imagine, and the article says you can imagine some sort of cataclysmic terrorist attack in America where the same thing happens. Do you, like, living in this world of The Handmaid's Tale, do you ever worry that something will happen?
Yes and no. I mean, I think I absolutely think that people can either manufacture or take advantage of a particularly convulsive moment, a terrorist attack, you know, the Reichstag fire, the Indian attacks in the Puritan times were used to clamp down on everybody. Indian attacks where like three people died. I mean, it was not, not massacres. There's always that possibility. And I feel that possibility with this administration because it seems like such an insecure group. On the one hand, you can absolutely see that happening. I always worry about my own imagination with those things because I'm paid to have a really, really good imagination. And so, I don't have any idea whether I'm actually looking at something that's real or just looking at something that I think would be a good idea. I extrapolate really well. And I lie exceptionally well. Those are my two jobs. But I can see those kind of situations aligning. I am not a big believer in kind of the idea that worldwide cataclysm. I just don't think it's very likely just because it's a big world. One of our problems is we've got so many people and they're spread all over the planet. One of the great things is we have so many people and they're spread all over the planet. So, one day there is going to be a day where a meteor comes and slams into Earth and, wipes out anything that's here. Will we still be here? I don't know, but it's going to happen. It's just math. But with a human-born problem, like a political problem, like what we have in Gilead or the Hunger Games kind of feeling, trying to make a show where you really have to think through what Gilead would be doing, it seems so hard and so unlikely and so impossible to – Americans and humans in general are so ornery and how do you say the word? Obstreperous. They are just, Americans particularly really don't like being told what to do. And I think they'd rather, rebel against something, even if they disagree with it. They just like to not do what people tell them. Certainly my 12-year-old daughter feels that way. And I think that's a really good human trait that keeps us from being put under the thumb for very long in terms of the totalitarian regimes that have existed. It's tough, man. I mean, it takes a lot of work and a lot of true believers, and it also takes a ton of trust in a scenario, in a setup that is built on not trusting. You got to trust all these people to execute your orders while making sure that you don't trust anybody else there in the world. And I don't think they last that long. I don't think it's kind of a natural state. So in terms of like a totalitarian takeover, that's
we won't be living in Gilead.
I don't think so. I think one of the great things about the show is that everybody across the political, moral, and religious spectrum can agree that Gilead sucks.
Oh yeah.
For everybody, for the people who are in charge, for the people who are not in charge, it's a ridiculous nth degree version of Old Testament justice that is a horror show. Now, in a world where the fertility rate fell precipitously for 10 or 15 years and all of a sudden there were no children and schools were closing down, I can certainly see this something this extreme happening. When people are terrified, they take huge jumps and huge chances. And I completely understand that's why Gilead works. And that's one of the things when you think about the show that you have to incorporate in your thinking that this is Gilead in our show takes place in the present. It's today. The past is different though. The past is a past where the fertility rate had been falling for a very long time. So things changed culturally, psychologically, politically way before Gilead came along. The features of the society that needed to be softened for Gilead to get a foothold happened over a long period of time with this thing in the background. And unlike the convulsion of the Reichstag fire or 9/11 or something like that, this is the kind of slow burn that changes society, but something that is an existential crisis, so people are terrified. So I think that, it more is akin to climate change, I think, than to a terrorist attack, just in terms of how really extremist parties get entrenched over time.
So you're saying I shouldn't buy any more earthquake supply kits?
No, absolutely. Certainly buy earthquake supply kits. There's nothing more fun than eating them when they are expiring. Because then you sit down and go, thank God there wasn't an earthquake.
I've got some pretty good MREs in my
basement. Yeah, absolutely. The kids,
want to come over,
how old's your child?
We have a 2-year-old and a 4-month-old.
Oh, so. See, yeah, they'll love it.
Dried ice cream.
They'll go through all of that stuff. It's going to be great.
Can you give us, maybe you can, and it's totally okay if you can, but can you give us any teasers for the next season?
Hell with you. Of course, in season two, in the first season, we cover a good part of the book in terms of the plot, but there are so many things in the first season, as I said, that were one sentence and we turned into a whole show. And there were things that were one sentence we wanted to turn into a whole season. I mean, when you think about the other elements of this world, just other places in this world, the colonies, what's going on in Little America in Toronto and a resistance movement outside of Gilead, like the English Jews trying to have people bomb, have the military bomb Auschwitz and stuff like that. All of these areas that are, pressing in and affecting June, but you don't see them in the book except they're mentioned because June's point of view is so limited. So we want to explore a lot of those places, and also I think the biggest thing is you want to put June in a new position, not necessarily a new place, but a new position in that place. And her status has changed quite a bit at the end of the first season when she discovers she's pregnant. The life of a pregnant handmaid and the life of a non-pregnant handmaid are very, very different things. All of a sudden, whereas before they were, your body is a vessel, it's an empty vessel. Here they're looking past you to a child. You're literally a walking incubator. And so no matter how angry you get at the walking incubator, you don't want to unplug it. People have to treat June differently. But I think we've got lots and lots of stuff to do. And I love the flashbacks that we've been doing. I feel like are just scratching the surface in terms of seeing people's lives and those little pivot points in people's lives that you don't notice them when they happen. But then looking back, you say, oh, that was the end of this and the beginning of this. I didn't really see that coming.
So we walk around the house and we'll say things like under his eye and blessed be the fruit. Do you all do that in the writer's room and at home? And
it is often the sign off for most emails. I think it's the
what's the top one?
Under his eye.
Under his eye.
There was a very brief time where Lizzie started to call me the commander, where I put the kibosh on that quite quickly. I do not want to get into that. That is a particular psychological minefield I do not want to get close to. And I in no way, shape, or form want to be lumped in with the commander. Yes, all those things, all those pieces of language seep in. And it was very funny because when you read the book and you think, I'm going to write this in a script, that's going to sound so dorky. It's not going to work. And it really does. I mean, the actors found, committed themselves to it and made it seem like their hellos and goodbyes. And that's just a miracle, that ability to kind of make something that seems so written seem so casual. And so it was the same thing with the costumes. One of the things every department we focused on was making sure the costumes look like real people costumes. And they look like things people wear, and they're dirty, and they're worn out, and because they're wearing them every day. And I think it's the same thing with the language. They made it worn out. They made it part of their lives. And to the point where you realize, and I think the reason you say it and the reason I say it, to friends and stuff, is that the statements in and of themselves are actually kind of sweet. Mm-hmm. It's like, peace be with you, go in grace, under his eye, which is a little creepier than some of the others, but blessed be the fruit and all these things. And I think that there's something about it there's a irony when people use it, but also it's kind of on its face, what you realize is before it gets twisted up, it's kind of nice. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I think that Gilead, one of the reasons you feel so ooky when you watch the show is that Gilead does some things really well. Boy, it's pretty. Boy, it's you know, so you know, there's not very much pollution. You know, all these things they do really well. It's safe, and so you know, it's like meeting a friend who's a terrible human being, but they make great pasta. You know, do you ask them for the recipe, or is it evil person pasta who you hate and you don't want their pasta? The pasta's still good. And so here, you know, can you separate the good things and the bad things out from Gilead without feeling like you're a Gilead defender by saying, wow, it would be nice if we reduced our carbon emissions by 45%.
So the last question I ask everyone before I wrap up is, if you could go back in time 20 years, 10 years, whatever it is, and give your younger self some advice, what would it be?
Be patient. I read this book in 1987, and now I'm running the show. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do it. My writing wouldn't have been good enough. I've been married for 22 years, 23 years. I have three children. I have a life. I know people who have been through a lot of ups and downs. And I think that patience is something that I wasn't particularly patient when I was younger, and it's something I've grown to be more patient. But I think that people say, oh, don't give up on things. And I think it's different than that. Don't actively give up. Don't throw stuff away. Put stuff on a shelf. There's no reason that just because someone tells you you're never going to write Handmaid's Tale as a series that you're not. I mean, until it's a series or even after it's a series. I can't tell you the number of times someone said, oh, don't go out and pitch that. They're making another movie or series about that, and yours will never go. And then the thing that they talked about that was absolutely going to go never amounts to anything. So just remembering kind of being comfortable in the things that you think are cool and interesting and you would like to see as movies. Your opinion is just as valid as anybody else's. And just to be patient.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to my guest, Bruce Miller. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Digital Media for their production work, and thanks, of course, to my sponsors, SeatGeek and Betterment. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll leave you with this last little word, under his eye.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.